Yes. Wow, what a laugh I had today. Yep. Went to visit someone I haven't talked to or seen in many a year. And his name is Perry Lefko. Yeah. We had some fun on his show, Next Sports Star, NSS TV on the internet, of course. And I felt right at home, not just because of Perry, but I also felt right at home because John Granger called. A very enjoyable time, let me tell you. And we'll be doing it again, which means for those fans of Candid Frank Live, we'll have to accept the fact that we will be rejigging the show times. That is correct. And how will it affect you? You know, you get the link, you know the general time we're on here, and, you know, it'll all work out. So I can tell you right now that I'll be on NSS television once a week for the, well, until Perry gets tired of me. And when he does get tired of me, I'm not going to add more time here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm hoping that we'll be okay forever. Perry and I have some ideas, and I'm very glad that he's willing to share his with me, as I am with him. So, great writer, great history. I'm looking for some independence. He might as well. And wish us luck on the minor endeavors that we'll be locking horns on. Soon to be experienced at a home near you. Now, I have been forced to go to my computer upstairs. Now, John Granger advised me many times, the sound here, not so good. Well, I'm here for a reason. Part of the reason why I am late a few minutes. So tonight, a very special show. Jan Carinci, born February 2nd, 1959, in London, England. Played college ball in Maryland. He is, of course, a former slot back. That was his main position, but that was not the only position he played. He was very, very interchangeable with other within other positions, even a place kicker. In fact, he held the ball for Louis Pasaglia's world-breaking record. Okay, maybe it wasn't world-breaking, but something like that. So he played 10 total seasons in the Canadian Football League, 5 seasons for the Argonauts, equally 5 seasons for the BC Lions, 81-85 for the former, and 86-90 for the BC Lions. Arguably, in 1981, I believe he was a rookie, he played on what arguably, probably, most people believe, the worst team in Toronto Argonaut history. Now, that's a long history. And the Argos, being what the Argos are, lost a lot of games. And this was the pinnacle. 29 years after they won their last Grey Cup. So, in a short 2 years later, Jan and his buddy Dan and the rest of the Argos won the 1983 Grey Cup. That's right. Jan Carinci and Dan Ferrone, as they left the game. Actually, there's a very famous picture taken of the two of them. In this interview, Jan will talk about that picture and how important it is to him. And obviously, he's very close to Dan Ferrone. And together, two Canadians, let's keep that in mind as well, were the poster boys for the 1983 Grey Cup Championship. So, he'll talk to us about the experience of winning, riding in the antique cars. But ironically, later, he would be traded to the same BC Lions that they beat in their home stadium, the first ever domed Grey Cup game. He was traded to the BC Lions, and while he was there, he developed his post-career after football. He sat behind a mic, color commentary for the BC Lions, while building his business plans. And by the way, he won awards for his businesses that he started. So he clearly had a business acumen. Then moved with his family to Moncton, New Brunswick, where he wrote a sports column for the Times and Transcript newspaper, among those other businesses that he began in BC. So obviously he couldn't get rid of that sports bug. But, yes, he did. Eventually, his sports column writing days, I think, ended, but he does it still from time to time. His family then moved to the island of Mauritius. It's an island about the size of Mississauga, Ontario, which is a fair-sized city, but still only that city. And that island is east of Madagascar, which is east of Africa. And this island finds itself in the Indian Ocean, where we speak to Jan today. Now, an afternoon with Jan Carinci, former Argo, broadcaster, newspaper writer, business owner and operator, still excited to talk about football. Football in Toronto, his friends that he made in Toronto and left behind. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to bring you my new friend and very interesting man, Renaissance man, in fact. I should say, to ensure that nobody confuses anything, I have edited this interview. And I did the best I could to edit out my voice. I've gone on for a few minutes here, and I will only interject a couple of times for a very short time. Ladies and gentlemen, Jan Carinci, Island Boy, Castaway, football player, and a wonderful gentleman.
Hello. So there was one Grey Cup victory with the Argonauts, 1983, 30th year anniversary coming up this year. Selfless plug, there will be a celebration at the Calgary game, August the 23rd, and probably all of your old-time favorites from the 83 team, Connor Holloway, Carl Brazley, Terry Greer, Dan Ferrone, and even me, making the trip from Mauritius, which, as you said, southwestern Indian Ocean, 8,000 miles from Moncton, which was the last place I lived in Canada, all the way back to Toronto.
And I remember a story you told me about taking out the golf clubs for the first time in Mauritius. Tell the folks about that.
That was hilarious. I've got an iPhone, and on the iPhone I've got a GPS golf app that tells me how far it is away I am from, you know, whatever hole I happen to be on, at whatever golf course I'm playing. And I had always had it set up to be on the golf course that I was playing in New Brunswick in Moncton, which was Royal Oaks. And I guess I hadn't turned it off the last time I used it, because when I turned it on here, it immediately took me to the Royal Oaks map. And it said, you are 8,332 miles away from the pin on the seventh hole at Royal Oaks. Now, what would have been funny about that is that when it said at the bottom, we suggest you use driver. But you kind of get the gist of the story.
Now, that is funny. And you did mention that you lived in Moncton, New Brunswick. You've been a person who's traveled. I mentioned earlier that you were born in London, England. You came to Toronto, right? Your family came to Toronto, and that's where you picked up the football bug?
we came to Toronto when I was six, okay? And it wasn't the football bug that I picked up, rather the hockey bug, because this was 1966. And those of you old enough as you and I are, Frank, will remember that in 1966-67, what happened?
The Leafs won the Cup.
Exactly. So I became a huge Leaf fan, you know, back in the glory days of the original six, and just was all set to you know, later, you know, after that summer, to play hockey at the age of nine. And right, I think it was the middle of August or maybe beginning of September, my neighbor up the street, Larry Aiken, came to me and he said, listen, we play football. Do you want to play football? And I went, oh, that sounds like fun. Okay, sure. And he was a real football fan and instrumental in making me a football player rather than a hockey player. I couldn't skate to save my life anyway, so that probably wasn't going to happen. But we played in the Scarborough Boys Football League in the East End of Toronto, and it was a weight league team, 90 pounds and under, and I played on the Scarborough Mustangs, age nine, and I was an offensive center. And all I knew that I was supposed to do was just give the ball to the quarterback, and I probably would just fall down and you know, try to get in someone's way that was trying to tackle the guy that had the ball for our team. But I had no idea what I was doing. The only thing that I remember was that at the time, there was a guy playing in the CFL who wore number 44, the same number that I had. His name was Basil Bark.
BB Bark.
Yeah, B-squared. So good old Basil Bark was my hero for all of 1 year. And then over the following winter and spring, I grew about 3 or 4 inches, and it seemed like everybody else didn't. And that following year, I still played for the Scarborough Boys Football League, the Scarborough Mustangs, and I was a running back, and I wore number 14, and that's when I started really paying attention to the CFL, because number 14 for the Toronto Argonauts was Dave
Keon.
Come on. Nope. I've tested you here.
Number 14, what year?
Played both ways.
Oh, not Toronto that. Argonauts.
And was still Winnipeg.
No.
Do you need to call a lifeline?
You got me.
Okay, I got you. Dave Ramey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, great football player, two-way player, which, you know, unbeknownst to me, I would go on to play two ways. Some would say greatly, some would not. That's when I got hooked. And after that, it was I couldn't get enough football. Ended up switching teams and going and playing for the East Gilwood Argonauts. Under coached by a guy by the name of Bill Jukes. And I don't know if anybody in Toronto is listening right now, but Bill Jukes coached me from the time I was 11 till the time I was 17, went to Maryland. And on his coaching staff was a man by the name of John Case. And Mr. Case, as we would call him, was our equipment manager and also our offensive line coach. John Case died yesterday after a battle with cancer. That they found out about in December. So Any fans in Toronto that Scarborough especially that remember John? Great man, great role model for us kids back then, in who taught us the real meaning of responsibility and of volunteerism, especially for a guy that would be there at every practice, every game, just encouraging us to play as well as we could, be as good as we could. So we just want to acknowledge that, if I could. Thanks.
Well, there is football in Canada would not exist without volunteers.
For me, it was more than high school football. It was the Scarborough Boys Football League. And again, back to your point on the volunteers and the coaches and their wives that would wash the uniforms and cut oranges at halftime and all this stuff. And I would play Scarborough Boys Football League. We would practice two or three times a week. We were play our games on the weekend. And I would do that after practicing every day of the week and playing games with our high school team. The bug is one way of saying it. I like to call it a passion. If you can get a kid involved in a passion as early as possible, that kid will grow up the right way and adopt the things that you want your child to be. A kid who has a passion about something is an amazing thing. They're driven. They just want it. It's all consumed by this thing, whatever it is, whether it's the piano, whether it's football, whether it's whatever it is. And it's really neat to see. I'm watching my daughter right now kind of get that bug with swimming. We just got back from her hour in the pool today, and she said to me, "Daddy, you know what? The front crawl, I'm nailing it. I'm starting to get it. It's happening for me." And when you hear that excitement in her voice, that's kind of cool. Yeah, there's got to be balance. There's got to be all this other stuff, especially the academics. But we would practice, and in high school especially, we were good. We had some good football players on the teams that we had. Mike Kirkley was a first round draft choice, a running back that was on the same team that I was on. Bill Mitsoulas was a wide receiver that played on the same team. You know, Rob Owen, a guy that tragically, gosh, this is two deaths on the same show, Frank, who tragically died, in grade 13, was a great football player, probably would have made it to the CFL. We were good, and at the same time, we knew it. We played in what would now be considered the Metro Bowl against Wexford. Wexford was like 32-0. They were unbelievable. We beat them 32-12. Wow. In the championship game, we just crushed it. Just absolutely steamrolled, and that's how good we were. On the other side of it, the team that Bill Jukes, who was my coach, again from the time I was 11 till I went to Maryland, we formed a team after we came out of the Scarborough Boys Football League called the Scarborough Vikings. Scarborough Vikings won four consecutive Ontario championships. And played a team. They would have these. The last one that I remember was in Hamilton. The big games were played at Iverwind Stadium. And a team came up from Cincinnati called the Cincinnati Tomahawks. And they looked just like the Cincinnati Bengals. They had warm-up jackets. They had all of this equipment. I mean, there must have been like 60 of them on the sideline. And we kicked off to them. Now, this is an American, serious football team. We kicked off to them. They took the ball back, I don't know, 60, 70 yards. I miss a tackle. They're up 7-0. The game's 15 seconds old. We beat them 67-7. Okay? We just trashed them.
Sounds like your 81 year with the Argos.
Well, in reverse. But we were good. And it was and Jukes was the type of coaches would say, don't ever get out hit. And teams would fold on us in the third quarter because we would just out-punish them. The famous Vince Lombardi sweep, we're going to keep running it and running it and running it until that corner and that halfback and that defensive end are so pounded that they're just going to lay down. And that's football. That's why there's so much football terminology in World War One and World War Two. End sweep, blitz, all of it. It's war out there, and the strongest survive. And it's that's how I was taught how to play. I don't know that I could play right now in this era of, you know, A, protect the quarterback. B, you're not allowed to lower your head. C, don't hit with the crown of your helmet. D, you know, why don't we just go back to two-hand touch and see if that works, see if that'll sell tickets. I can guarantee you one thing.
What was different when you went to Maryland?
Oh, before I even got on the field, what was different was two-a-day practice every day. Two-a-day every day, 2 hours in the sweltering heat, which is Maryland, and just in case folks don't know exactly where we are just outside of the Beltway of Washington, D.C. Okay, it's hot, it's humid, it's two-a-days. There's 95 scholarship athletes down there running around on three football fields, plus all the guys that are silly enough to try to walk on, guys that don't have scholarships but think they can make the team, of which usually you'll get one or two guys, and there's been some great stories of great walk-ons, so I don't mean to bag on walk-ons. But the regimen of this whole thing was something that I wasn't used to, and to be honest with you, something I didn't like. And as a freshman down there, looking at this whole situation going, do I really want to do this for 4 years? When, you know, just, you know, this is August of 1977 now, when in May of 1977, the Toronto Argonauts had offered me a contract. And I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to do this? And forego, you know, the next 3 years waiting for you know, a chance to land with the Argonauts? And my decision was quite easily made. I said, no, I don't want to do this. And I continued to participate as far as the football side of things were concerned. I made the travel roster. I hardly ever played. There were two seniors and a junior ahead of me. Those were the guys that were playing. And then there was also two sophomores. So I'm looking at this going, unless I do something really spectacular in the springtime, I'm probably going to sit on the bench next year too. And I'm like, okay, I'm not doing this. I'm packing it in after the football season's done. I'm going to go back to Toronto and I'm going to contact the Argonauts and I'm going to see if they still want me to play, and you know, see how that goes. I get back to Toronto in December and I call Jim Copeland and I tell him the same story I just said. And he's the director of Canadian player
development.
Canadian player development, yeah. And he says to me, "Did you step on the field for Maryland?" I said, "Yeah, of course I did. I did play a little bit." And he said, "Well, you are now actually ineligible to play in the CFL as a Canadian until your class graduates in 1981." I didn't know that. And to be quite honest with you, Frank, I don't know if that's a true statement or not, or whether Jim was just trying to take care of my best interests. In other words, stay at Maryland, get your education, you will play. And I don't know whether or not, you know, whether or not it was the truth or whether or not he was looking after my best interests. Long story short, I go back to Maryland. I go to summer school and if you're talking, I was a 4-year honors student at Agincourt, okay? You're talking about a guy who has to go to 2 semesters of summer school just to remain eligible for a scholarship, because the first semester I was down there, once I realized I wasn't staying, I didn't go to class.
Oh, no.
Okay? Oh, absolutely. Oh, no. I was down there playing football and having a good time.
Now, it wasn't just your decision to stay there. From what I understand, your family also, you know, the same way Copeland did, gave you sound advice and support.
Yeah, that was in training camp, and there was, that definitely happened. I was lonely. I hadn't really been away from home. You know, 17 years old, I hadn't been away from home for an extended period of time at all, and my parents were very supportive, and I had two very, very young brothers at the time. I think Tino was 6 and Marco was 4, and you know, they came down and I would play with the kids all the time. We were always rough and tumble whenever I was I was around with them, and there was great support from them. And but that was at the beginning of the season. My thought process hadn't changed by the end of the season. It's patience. It was a lot of hard work. I not only did I have to get my grades back. I had to get in the gym. I had to hit the weights. I had to do everything, because it seemed through winter workouts. This is a funny story. I come back after the second semester. So we're talking spring of 1978 now. And my dad looks at me and says, "What's going on?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when in high school, you played football, basketball, and you ran track and field. And, like, what are you doing at Maryland? All you're doing is playing football." I said, "Wait a sec, Dad. You know what? They give me a football scholarship. They give other guys basketball scholarships, and they give other guys track and field scholarships. Okay? And in football at Maryland, you go to training camp 2 days, then you play the season. Then they give you if you're lucky enough to go to a bowl game, you have to practice 3 weeks for that, which we did my freshman year. Then you come back, and it's now, you know, it's winter, it's the off season. Then you do indoor training for 5 weeks. And then by the time that's done, you have March break, and then you do spring football. When do you find time for me to play basketball and run track and field?" So he got educated on that side of things. But midway through winter workouts, still in my freshman year going into my sophomore year, I started to look around and I started to see myself performing better than the upperclassmen that were ahead of me. And I knew that in spring ball, if I could take what I was doing in the workout sessions and put it on the field, then I probably had a really good chance to start. And that's motivation. And the grades were coming together. I was right back studying and doing all of the things that a student athlete is supposed to do. And I started to get pretty excited about the next 3 years that were ahead of me. And sure enough, I ended up winning the starting job in spring football my freshman year. And then, stayed down there the entire summer working on the grades. And by the time the next fall practice came along, I was already penciled in. See, we better kind of just take a quick step back. I came second in receiving in my sophomore year with 21 receptions. And this is a football team. The University of Maryland, my dad would have a saying, you know, they run the ball left, they run the ball right, and to make things different, they run the ball up the middle. We didn't pass unless it was third and 19. And usually when we did that, it was coming to me. So to finish leading the team as a junior in receptions with 30 catches, that was quite a bit back then. Now kids are. I look at G. Roy Simon, his senior year at Maryland. You've heard that name, I think. Yes. His senior year at Maryland, I think he caught 80 passes. And didn't lead the ACC in receptions. So I was like third in the league in receptions with 30 catches back in 1979. So, you know, it was progressing, things were going well, and then, you know, 2 days before training camp my senior year, I'm in there lifting weights with linebackers for some really stupid reason. I give my hand a shake every time I think about it. And I'm trying to put up too much weight. I'm trying to bench 275, which back then was respectable. Now it's nothing. And my right leg slipped, my left leg took all the weight, and I tore cartilage, the meniscus on my knee, and it's got big as a basketball, and I had to have surgery to replace it the day training camp started, my senior year. There I am, preseason all ACC, coming off of an all ACC academic dean's list junior year. All of the hype, all of the this, all of the that, and it just got trashed with that one silly little bench press accident. So now you finish the season. I finished the season with 9 catches. We go to the Tangerine Bowl. me and Chris Collinsworth have a little bit of a duel. You remember that name? He catches a few more balls than I do. Florida beats us in the Tangerine Bowl, and now it's time to look at, you know, what's next. The Argonauts back in the day had two territorial protectorates. That ended, I think, in 1984-85. And what a territorial protectorate was you had the right to protect a player that grew up in your area of influence. Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, there was no combine, CFL or NFL. But what NFL scouts would do, they would come to your school and they would, check out players. They would create a list for your coaches to come up with the players and provide them with. Well, one of the guys that was fairly well, there were several guys that we had that were fairly heavily recruited. Eric Stevers, who played for the San Diego Chargers for 10 years, Lloyd Burris with the Kansas City Chiefs for 11, Mike Tice, still active in the NFL as a coach for Chicago, was a tight end for Seattle and Minnesota, John Tice's brother, same thing. So when you've got a defensive back that they want to take a look at, they being the NFL, in your backyard, in your practice facility, well, you need a receiver to run routes against them, right?
Yeah.
And you need a quarterback to throw the ball. So Lloyd Burris, Mike Tice, who would go on to be NFL, 10, 11, 12-year guys, and me catching Tice's balls running routes against Lloyd. Well, I ran routes against Lloyd for the last 4 years. I knew what I could do and I knew what I couldn't do. So now, all of a sudden, I'm catching balls against this guy who's projected to be a second or third round draft choice, and they're coming up to me going, what are your plans? Anyway, the long and the short of it was they were Philadelphia, the Giants, and Minnesota were talking free agent contract, but each one of them, and this wasn't done in a group. Each one of them individually said, "But you'd be crazy not to go back to Toronto. They've got two protectorates that they can just pick you right off the pot. You're not going to even be in the draft." And at the time, the CFL was paying comparably, almost on par with a sixth, seventh round draft choice in the NFL. The NFL wasn't, I mean, you remember back in the 80s, guys were getting, first round draft choices were getting plucked. Bruce Clark in 1980 out of Penn State was a first round draft choice, played with Toronto Argonauts. There was a linebacker with Montreal. There were several players that were high draft choices. The CFL was paying a lot of money in the 80s. And guys were going north, and they said to me, you'd be crazy. So, the offensive coordinator for the Argonauts visited the school roughly about the same time. So you're talking about this is April, May of 1981. And his name was Steve Goldman. And he arranged to come in and sit down and have dinner with the team and talk to me while I was having dinner. So you've got 95 guys sitting around, big tables of 10. And there's me and Steve sitting all by ourselves at one of these other tables, and we're eating, and he's got all of his Argonaut gear on, and guys are like looking and going, what the heck is going on? Because you got to remember, training camp starts in a month, right? In the NFL, training camp wasn't starting until August. So he looks at me and he goes, so listen, if we protect you, will you come to Toronto and play for the Argonauts? And he was quite serious. They didn't know. And I was just sitting there waiting for the invitation. Sitting there going, of course I'm coming. I didn't say that, but like, are you crazy? Of course I'm coming. Yes, I think that would be a good career move for me.
And it really was.
Like, well, I couldn't hardly compose myself. You're talking about a 22-year-old kid who had watched McQuay fumble, cried my eyes out during that one, okay? Watched every Argo game from the time I was, 11 on. And now I get to come back and play for Argonauts? Oh, yeah, I think this is good. This is what I want.
Can I add something in there? Also, it was the heyday of the Toronto Argonauts. they were drawing, I think, what, around 40,000 people, anywhere between 30, 40, and sometimes, they filled Exhibition Stadium.
Yeah, all the good seats.
Yeah.
Certainly all the good seats. I mean, what they did to Exhibition Stadium to accommodate the Blue Jays was ridiculous, but certainly all the good seats, and yeah, it was a hating. It was like the Leafs. They were selling out, but they weren't winning.
Right.
You know, just goofy, and spending a lot of money.
Absolutely.
You know? So,
and bringing
yeah.
some serious talent up north.
I was. Yeah, but their serious talent was always focused on Americans.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, you've got to have quality Americans playing. There's no doubt about that. Especially your quarterbacks, obviously. And some of your other skill position guys. And we're starting to see. When I played in the CFL, it was very, very easy to tell who the Canadians were and who the Americans were. Now it's getting, with the way Canada has the culture in Canada has changed. It's very difficult. I mean, we're seeing kids that I can remember having to translate between an American defensive back and a Canadian defensive back who was very, very Jamaican. And they couldn't understand each other, okay. And it's a bit of a joke, but it's also reality. Now, those there's no confusion at all. You don't know who's who. You don't know who's Canadian, who's American, until you read it in the program. And it's amazing. It says a lot for the development of the Canadian player in the last 25 years. It really does.
Jan, I think. Anyway, at some point. I won't define it, but at some point it became clear to all the CFL teams, obviously from one to the next and to all of them, that your Canadian content, as it did this year for the Toronto Argonauts, can win you a championship.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for a date on the CFL calendar that probably best exemplifies that, is the 5 years that the Edmonton Eskimos won the Grey Cup. Yeah, I mean, their Canadian talent was unbelievable. When was the last time you saw a fullback like Neil Lumsden?
No.
Are you kidding me? I don't think there's been one since.
No, not at all.
And he's just one example of a bunch of guys, Marco Sinkar, the guys that they had offensive line. It didn't matter. Every position, they had quality Canadians, and I think that to Bob Obilovich's credit is what he focused on in 19, as he was coming into 1982 as the head coach, and of course Ralph Stasio.
Hang on, you're getting ahead of me here. You're getting ahead of me. Let's take a step back.
I don't want to talk about 81.
Well,
you have to.
Yeah, we do. It was your rookie year, and I've seen it quoted that even though you played all 16 games, it could be defined as a nightmare year for you. What made it such a nightmare?
I don't know if we have time.
Oh, no.
Okay, lose the first 11 straight. That's the first one. We end up 2-14. We still had a chance to make the playoffs if we win the last game. I try to catch a pass. I don't even know if it was Connors who threw. I don't think it was, because Connors would have hit me in the numbers. But if I catch this ball between my knees, which is where it was thrown, and roll into the end zone, we beat Hamilton the last game of the year and still make the playoffs. I'm right now in the middle of going through a bunch of pictures for Paul Woods. I know you're familiar with his project, Bouncing Back, the story of the book that's being written on the 83 Argo team. And I saw a press clipping that my mother, bless her soul, my mother had saved for me. And it's a picture of me throwing a cup of cold water on my face. And the tagline reads, "Oops, missed again." And the little cut line underneath says sure, we could say that rookie Argonaut receiver Jan Karinci, had trouble finding his mouth. That would probably be appropriate given the fact that the Argos are having such a miserable season. But we won't say that. We'll just say that he was just trying to cool off. on a hot day in Lamport Stadium as we were practicing. But that's what we were getting. You know, the ultimate insult was the Toronto Blue Jays at the time not allowing us to cut into, and those who remember the X, remember that at the end of the left field line, there was an opening. And that opening was where they would bring in the big equipment for the concerts. That was where your big stuff would come in. All the Argonauts of that miserable 1981 year wanted to do as we left practice at the grass field while the Blue Jays were just getting ready to start a game were to walk in that entrance, walk underneath the catacombs of the stadium to our locker rooms, which meant that we would not have to walk through the 40,000 people that were getting ready to go to the Blue Jay game that just did nothing but taunt us. And in the summertime, you know how many baseball games are played. This would happen 2-3 times a week.
Yep.
We would just get just ridiculed, like just every single slur you could possibly imagine delivered that year. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible year. And there are a few fun memories, but not very many. And I don't know if it made us stronger. I guess it did, because the core guys were back in 82. And we can go on and discuss.
Did you have a sense that in 81, through the terrible experience, that there were some building blocks there, young building blocks in management and the players, that you knew you could turn this thing around?
There definitely was no building blocks in management. Okay? They fired all of them. You know, and there were certain firings that were really, you know, you look back now and professional sports is a cruel game. Okay, you are only as good as what you've done for me lately, and you know, unfortunately, a great guy like Willie Wood, you know, we lose, I think, our first four games in 1981 by a total of 7 points, and you know, you can correct me on that one while I'm you know, yapping here, but. You know, Willie was a great guy, but he was just a victim of wins and losses. And then they brought in some people that, you know, you constantly hear in the CFL about guys coming in with CFL experience as head coaches. Mm-hmm. And the guys that they brought in were all Americans. They, you know, very few of them had CFL experience. And I got to tell you one quick story, and then we'll start talking about the players. But we were getting ready to play somebody. I can't remember who it was, and we had lost. We were probably like 0-6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever. And this assistant coach, he was charged with giving the pregame speech, and it was a great speech. He went on and on about you know, the tough get going and the going get tough and the this and the that and every cliche you ever heard. And it was actually working. I looked around the room and I could see guys were, you know, the back was starting to straighten and the chin was coming out. Everything was like, you know, coming together. And he ended it with the following. Now, get out there like good, young, red-blooded Americans and kick some ass.
And you did. No.
And all the Canadians looked around and went, ah.
Here we go. There it is. Great coach. But Willie Wood, you mentioned, and you seem to have a real soft spot for him. This is a guy who won Super Bowl I with the Green Bay Packers. This is a guy who had all kinds of respect for his football mind. And if it wasn't for the color of his skin, he may not have needed to come to the Argos. He could have coached in the NFL. And like you said, I think he just caught a bad break, and he didn't get a chance to learn the Canadian game, and he was jettisoned. And the good news is Ralph Sazio came in. Now you have Bob Obilovich, who comes from Ottawa as an assistant coach, and you have a guy who understands the Canadian game and the fact that Canadians play it. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, just to finish on Willie, and you know, I think he was a victim of ownership, and a GM that was you know too active in telling him what it was that he wanted him to do. was very unfortunate because Willie was a great guy. You know, he'd be out there. I made my money that year returning punts and playing on special teams, but he'd be out there at the beginning of practice trying to return punts. And this is a man who was in the National Football League Hall of Fame. Obviously, as you said, won the first Super Bowl and played for Vince Lombardi. So you learn a few things, especially if you're going to become a coach, when you played for a guy like Vince Lombardi. And he'd be out there just, you know, he'd be out there 45, 50 pounds heavier than his playing days trying to return punts. And they, you know, you cradle a punt when you're catching it. And, well, Willie's stomach was getting in the way. So the ball would bounce off and he'd laugh. And then we decided that we would get a little tricky here. And when you're a punt returner and you know what you're doing, you're capable of catching a ball behind your back. And this is a punt that is, you know, got a four or five second hang time. If you time it out properly, you can do it. Well, Willie saw me and Dave Newman doing this, and he decided he'd never seen this done before. So he thought this was just the greatest thing to try. I'm not kidding you. We delayed practice a half hour one day until Willie finally did it. He's out there, and he's getting hit in the head with the ball. He's bouncing off his shoulders. It's hitting his butt. Everything. Now the entire team's out there waiting, right, just waiting for him to finally do this. And sure enough, he got one. Okay, come on, man. Let's start practice now. It was just great. But no, you've got to have a guy that's got a little bit of control. And the biggest thing that we thought when Ralph Stasio came into the organization that he would want to control OB. But to his credit, Ralph gave OB a lot of freedom because OB had played in the – as did Ralph, played in the league and coached and assistant coach anyway. And knew the game, knew what to do. You asked me about, you know, before we got all tangled up with management, you asked me about players and whether or not there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And yeah, definitely, no question about it. You talk about Connie Holloway to start, okay? And Connie's a guy that was not only a great athlete, but was a great leader and a great leader, as far as I'm concerned, is someone who can get the most out of each and every individual teammate, whether you know you're talking about a football team or whether or not you're talking about a corporation. And I think that Connie would be gifted if someone would ever take him and say, okay, you're going to be the CEO of my company. I think he'd do very well. He had a way of relating with everybody, from the guy who was, you know, out in the bars for the first 3 or 4 days of practice, if not seven, to the guy who was, you know, a born again Christian and everything in between. So there's your leader. There's where it starts. And then trickle down from there, and you've got a guy like Cedric Minner. You've got a guy like Paul Pearson, who, you know, just a great slot back, one of the best slots that the league's ever had. Terry Greer, Dan Ferroni, okay, Roland Mangle, Tom Trefo, John Malinowski on the offensive line. Great football players, all of them. And then you throw in a couple of defensive players, you know, Carl Brazley, Lamont Meacham on the defensive line, Franklin King, character players, okay, that were already in the organization Carl we got through trades. And that's the other piece of it. The trades that they made in 82, Carl Brazley, Rick Moore, Don Moen, you've probably done the research, there's a few more, but guys on defense that they brought in that really, really, the James Curry, that trade, you know, Curry, huge game eventually down the road. You know, and then one guy that often gets forgotten, Darryl Mouse Davis, mm-hmm. and the author of the run and shoot offense. I mean, this guy's just a genius offensively. Just a genius.
It was also at that time known as the West Coast offense because it was something that came out.
Was it at that time, or did they hang the hat on the San Francisco 49ers West Coast offense after 1982?
I think after. I think you're right, after.
It was. I think it was. Because we were the run and shoot. And Daryl had used the run and shoot at the University of Hawaii with June Jones, if you remember that name.
Yep,
not,
yep.
With June Jones as his quarterback. June is now using a version of it, I believe, with Atlanta. Present day. I mean, someone will email us and tell us we're wrong on that one, but I think June Jones is with Atlanta and still using a version of Mouse's offense. But that offense, you couldn't touch it. You could not stop it because everything, it had a variation. If you did this, we did that. If you did this plus that, we did this plus that. And you could, once we got on the same page, once we all got on the same page, so you're talking, you know, at the time, Terry Greer, Jeff Townsend, Paul Pearson, Cedric Minner, and, you know, and myself filling in for all of those guys. Dave Newman was back there. We all had to know all of the routes that all of the receivers, and at that time you're talking five receiver sets, because the fullback at the time was a glorified offensive lineman who would turn around every once in a while, catch a screen pass. But the five guys all had to know what each other was doing, and most importantly, where they were doing it on the field. And that was critical. And it took us, I think, the first four or five games to get it down. I remember a headline, run and shoot misfires again. And you know, everybody was sitting there going, oh, here we go, same old Argos. And then once we got it, you know, it professional sports, just like going from high school to college, it's a very thin line. You have to step over it. College sports to professional sports, it's a very thin line to step over that. Being really good at the professional level is another very, very thin line. Once you figure out how to step over it, you got it. You've got it. And that's what that 82 team did. It took three, four, five games. Our defense kept us in a few of them because defense is just go crazy and hit people. But offensively, it took us a while to get his offense down. And once we did, look out.
And it was very Moon. You must be really proud of the fact that how people underestimate and don't appreciate how good the Canadian game is and how good that Argo team was. And people may not remember, there was some talk at that time that the Argos, or did they play exhibition games against... You have to put the mic on when you talk. What are you, a rookie?
I'm just a regular Joe with
yes,
a regular
I am.
Job. I'm your average white, least I'd like snob. I like porno and proline and books about porn. I got an average house with nice hardwood floors. My wife, my job, my kids and my car, my feet on my table, and a Cuban cigar. But sometimes that just ain't enough to keep a man like me interested.
Interested.
No way. Now I gotta wear double blue and hit the subway downtown.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. I need football big on a really big field. No silicone cheerleaders. I want my chicks real. I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
Yo,
yo, yo, yo, yo. I fly to D.C. and hide all their weed. I go to Regina and say, how about that wheat? I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo. Yo, 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 yo. I park in Commonwealth and take Edmonton spaces while Edmonton people make Edmonton faces. I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
Oh, yo, yo. Oh, yo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get myself one of those Condridge Holloway mess jerseys circa 1982 with the midriff showing, just like those skanky Queen Street Lady Gaga wannabes, and walk right into Harbor 60, and there's nothing nobody can do about it. Yeah. And I'm going to talk about the Argos on the radio anytime I want, because unlike that 60-year-old from the fan who wears sunglasses on TV, I actually go to the games. Okay. They can take their 20 years of boring people with their Dungeons & Dragons staff and have a great big 20-year-old cakewalk right in the middle of Young Street, and it will make it look a difference. You know why? Because we got the bombs. Yeah! We got Schultz, Dennegan, frickin' Naylor, and frickin' Randorf. I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get Bill Simons, Joel Kroll, Terry Greer, and frickin' Don Moen, and a giant case of Crown Royal, and we're gonna go right down!
Hey, you know what, pal? You really are an Argo.
Just shut up and sing the song, pal.
I'm an Argo!
He's an Argo!
I'm an Argo!
He's an Argo!
Hey, Argo! Oh, oh!
I'm an Argo, and I'm proud of it.
And you should be the great, talented, not late, but early in the morning, man, Mike Richards on TSN 1050. You guys got to listen to him and watch him. He's awesome. Best guy on radio. And what I like about him, he doesn't look like, well, I don't want to mention names, but some people look like they woke up off a park bench. Jeez. Not mentioning names, because I wouldn't do that. All right. As stated earlier, we're in the midst of an interview from Mauritius, an island in the Indian Ocean, east of Madagascar, which is east of Africa. Africa? Africa? Another way to pronounce it, I guess. Yeah, so, yeah, why don't we continue with the interview. And as promised, I do not interrupt very often.
Moon, you must be really proud of the fact that how people underestimate and don't appreciate how good the Canadian game is and how good that Argo team was. And people may not remember, there was some talk at that time that the Argos, or did they play exhibition games against NFL teams?
I would say, first of all, the Edmonton Eskimos. Okay, I would look at that team first and say, okay, now you go play the NFL. Now what game do you play? Do you play the Canadian one or the American one?
Absolutely.
Or do you play do we toss a coin and we play two Canadian games and one American one?
Or a half American, yeah. Half Canadian. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, do you remember, okay, I'm not going to go there. Let's just go back a second to what you said about widening the field. If you think about the pinpoint accuracy on the postage stamp field that the National Football League game is played on, that their quarterbacks have to have, it truly is amazing. Okay, when you consider that a 10-yard out in the National Football League is a 10-yard out. A 10-yard out in the Canadian Football League is a 40-yard pass. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
All right? If you're going from the left hash and you're dropping back and you go to the right side, it's a 40-yard pass. Okay, that's it. I firmly believe that if it was possible for 32 NFL teams to blow up their stadiums and create fields that were 65 yards wide, 110 long, and 20-yard end zones, they would do it in a blink of an eye. Why? Predominantly because offense sells tickets. Okay, you've seen a difference in the and this isn't anything new. You've seen the move from running game to a passing game, and it's never going to go back to a running game. They might do the wildcat thing with great athletes that are coming out that are playing quarterback right now, but predominantly it will continue to evolve as a serious passing game. So if you've got more room to throw the ball, you that is something that you desire. Secondly, the NFL game, when it gets in what they call the red zone inside the 20, it changes. You've played this game for 80 yards this way, and now you're inside the 20, and the whole thing changes. Why? Because you have 10-yard end zones. And defenses can be a lot more aggressive because they know that you run out of room. You've got to do something quick. So they would love to have another 10 yards back there in order to continue playing the game that they've been playing out in the middle of the field in the red zone. Okay? That said, it'll never happen. Too costly. You're talking about blowing up stadiums here, you know, and it's just not going to happen.
Well, not when you're spending billions on a stadium like Dallas did, I guess.
If it was going to happen, Jerry Jones would have done it, and then he would have pushed for the rule changes. The other thing that you mentioned was the games between the games, and that is that the National Football League has adopted just about every single rule change. Every single evolution of the game that there has been at least since in the CFL, at least since 19. Well, if you want to go back that far? I'm sorry, I'm dating myself now. I don't remember the 50s. So at least since I was playing college football, moving the ball back from the 45 to the 35 for kickoffs. Why? To have more kickoff returns in the National Football League. The elimination of the tight end as a mainstay offensively, the development of five receiver sets, empty backfields. This was all done in the CFL way before the National Football League ever contemplated it. And I mean, there's a whole book here waiting to be written on the evolution of the CFL and what the National Football did, looking at what the CFL was doing. And all of this happens because in what used to happen, I don't know if it still happens, but what used to happen was the CFL during Super Bowl week would go down and have their meetings. The owners' meetings would go down there, the rules committee meetings and the coaches' meetings and all this stuff would happen. The same time the NFL was having their pre-Super Bowl stuff. And the CFL would host anybody that wanted to come from the National Football League to a luncheon, and they would show a highlight film of the previous CFL season. They were like giving away all of the secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they did it was a good one. They were trying to get the National Football League to join into some sort of a partnership with the CFL whereby players were allowed to go back and forth freely. In other words, we got a guy that we think that we want to have in the NFL. Will you let him out of your contract? If he doesn't make it, we'll send him right back to you. Okay, and that in some way, shape, or form has happened. But the fact of the matter is, the CFL's evolution predates the NFL's revolution. Stand up defensive ends is another piece that we've been doing. James Crick Parker was the first one of those. Back in the early 80s, and all of a sudden the NFL went, oh, wow, look, Lawrence Taylor. Let's not have him in his three-point stance. Let's have him stand up. Every once in a while he'll drop off. Every once in a while he'll rush. It's that sort of stuff. Fans of the CFL and naysayers of the CFL need to understand that. And we have
people do
this game that the NFL would love to have.
Okay, we have
I think so. Once we got to the point where we were – We figured things out offensively. OB and Ralph had added some pieces to the puzzle defensively. Special teams, I think, were always very, very good because they had drafted some good Canadian players, Gord Elser, Rob Lowe, Jeff Townsend, Greg Holmes, some skill guys that could make stuff happen, both from a return game and from a shutting them down on the return game point of view. But I think that the telltale contest was the win against Edmonton at home on a really hot, muggy Toronto night, and we really put it to them. Terry and Conridge had an outstanding game. And when you beat a team that has, you know, done what no other team has done in the history of the league, and winning five Grey Cups, and you do it convincingly, you start to feel pretty good about yourself. So yeah, we after that game, and we still had the fall to play. We knew that we could have something special. That was actually the Eastern Final. We kicked off to them in the Eastern Final, and they went three and out. They punted. I took the ball about, I think, our own, 15 or 20, and I remember it clear as day. We had a right return on, and I didn't get touched until I got tackled. You say it was 59 yards later. I think you know, you talk about back to your comment about the crowd. There was probably 46,000-47,000 people in the X, and it was a decent day, and they just went nuts. And the offense came out on the field, and I think we ran a running play, and then Conridge rolled, did a bit of a half roll to his left, and then stopped, pivoted, and fired to Greer downfield, and Terry made a great catch, and all of a sudden it's 7-0, and you look out, Ottawa, wouldn't want to be you. Well, yeah, and it was, you know, we had guys on the team that had been there. Obviously, Conridge had won a Grey Cup with Ottawa in 76, but I think we were so green. A lot of us were very, very green that had been on the 81 team and gone 2-14, and now all of a sudden your great success, first round bye, you blow out Ottawa in the Eastern Final, and now you're up against, oh gee, guess who? Oops, Warren Moon, okay, both Hall of Fames, and his accompanying cast. So you're there, and you're downtown, and there's a party atmosphere, and we did okay in the first half of that game. Unfortunately, you know, and this is a famous run and shoot quote. You know, the naysayers would always say to Mouse, "What about your running game?" And Mouse says, "We run the ball after we catch it." And you know. So, you know, you've got an offense that is predicated on the pass, whether it be short or long, and you have a game in which at halftime, I don't know, 3 inches of rain fell in 15 minutes. It was ridiculous. We came back out there. I mean, Exhibition Stadium, the aisleways where the stairs are, and the exits where you walk, they were all flooded. There, I mean, people were surfing down the steps. At Exhibition Stadium, it was nuts. Edmonton, on the other hand, had you know, Neil Lumsden and Jim Germany, and they just said, okay, well, we're just going to pound the ball down your throats. And I don't think we scored a point in the second half, and they scored a couple of touchdowns and beat us pretty handily. I think the final score was 32-16 or something like that. It was very disappointing because we had a chance to win it at home, and you don't get a chance even in an 8 or 9 team league to do that. Obviously, the Argonauts did it this past season in the 100th Grey Cup, and congratulations to them for that one. But you don't get a chance to do it very often in your home stadium. So it was bitter, but at the same time, I think we knew we were capable of having another opportunity to get there again. And I think for the first time in a long time, the Toronto media knew it too. I got several articles talking about, you know, these new Argos, and everybody was sitting there saying they're so young and you know, they're not going anywhere. Everybody's under contract. And you know, Obilovich and Ralph Sazio had made that, you know, a stipulation as far as their mandate was concerned was keeping everybody around. And you know, everybody. I think everybody. I remember sitting in a dinner that was hosted by the city of Toronto, and everybody just sitting there going, "Yep, next year, baby, next year, we'll be there." Yeah, I think the first thing that needs to be pointed out at the beginning of '83 is the fact that the Argonauts made a decision to part ways with Daryl Mouse Davis. And, you know, that that really upset a lot of people, especially on the offensive side of the ball, especially a quarterback. And, you know, we brought in Joe Barnes, and now you're sitting there looking at a 1-2 punch that you know, nobody else has got. And we had always heard from Mouse that boys, next year we're gonna roll out phase two of the run sheet. And when you get a hold of an offense that you know, if everybody does what they're supposed to be doing, that basically can't be stopped, and all of a sudden the creator says, you're like you're watching a Star Trek movie. The creator says, guess what? There's part two. And you don't get to use it? Okay, all right. Well, fortunately, he'd given Condridge and Joe a peek, and they were able to develop the core of the offense, you know, throughout the 83 season. But it wasn't what it could have been. And when we found out that it was a monetary decision that was made, I mean, Mouse's family used to drive from Portland, Oregon to all of our away games. Imagine, mm-hmm. You're going to leave on Monday to get to Calgary or to get to Hamilton in time for the game on Sunday. So, you know, he had some monetary things that, you know, he wanted done, and they wouldn't do it. And he had to basically walk away from the team, and it was a very emotional departure. It really was. He was at training camp. He handed the reins over to Ed Klebeck, who, you know, unfortunately for Ed, just inherited. You know, he became the unwanted man. Okay, he was like persona non grata. It was just, you know, we had to play for him, but we wanted that other guy there, mm-hmm. And. You know, when he left and we got him a Grey Cup, we got him his Grey Cup ring, and you know, we had a special night, you know, just as a team for him. It was tough. It really was. But, you know, you go on because this is your job, this is your livelihood. You have to now, okay, we've lost one very, very key component to this organization. We now need to work with the other one or with its replacement. You know, and do as best we can. You know, always with the objective that we know we're good. We know we can get there because we did it last year, and now we feel we're a better organization from a player standpoint. We're not as good as an organization from a coaching standpoint, and I don't think there's anybody that would argue with me on that one, including the coaches that were there. But we're going to get this done. And I think that was the attitude going into training camp. That was the attitude that Mouse would have wanted us and did want us to have. And that's the way we approached the 83 season. With Hamilton's performance in the Eastern Final. I mean, they came up with a defense that I don't know who their defensive coordinator was back then, but they would play a version of man under two deep. And what that means is there's four defenders that would run with your four receivers, your two slots and your two wide receivers, and then they would play cover two over top of that. So anybody that went deep, the two guys back there for Hamilton would be responsible for those two guys. But at the same time, they would have guys trailing those guys. So it's what they call man under, mm-hmm. two deep. So you got a man sitting in the back pocket of a Paul Pearson. And at the same time, you got a guy sitting up on top. So where do you throw the ball? Okay. Now we had some plays designed for this defense, and certainly when you decide to put six guys back in pass coverage, you now have an opportunity to run the football. And we had gotten a little bit better at that with Cedric Minter having a little bit more of a presence rushing the football that season. Again, why? Because we were getting away from Mouse's run and shoot, because Mouse wasn't there anymore. So while the core of the run and shoot was still there, there were other things added from a okay, we got to keep them honest, we got to run the football every once in a while, and we have to develop a running game. So, you know, you've got this team that has done this, that has made some changes, that has gotten become a little bit more balanced offensively. And then you run into a Hamilton team that just had a great day. They were very, very good that day and had a lot of talent on that football team. And they're playing the Argos. There probably was, you know, 50,000 people at Exhibition Stadium. I remember it was a perfect autumn day for football. It was brisk, but it wasn't too cold. You know, there wasn't really any issues as far as it was a little bit wet, but nothing, you know, out of the ordinary. And it was almost to the point where, you know, the guy that has the ball last wins the game. And you know, we got a little help from the referees. Nice to see that happen to an Argonaut football team every once in a while, because God knows hasn't been the case for up until then at least. Mm-hmm. And we got an interference call against Howard Fields against Jeff Townsend. Jeff was running a corner route right in front of our bench, and Howard did something that the referee saw that no one else in the stadium saw. And all of a sudden, there was the flag, and that gave us the first down at about the Hamilton, I think it was about 45. And after that, you could kind of sort of see the wind go out of the sails of the Tiger Cats defense. They said, what? Wait a second. We played like our hearts out, and that call is going to extend the drive. The game should be, they should be punting, or they should be turning it over on downs. We should be winning this game. And they basically, at that point, were beaten. And we ran four or five more plays later, and with 27 seconds left to go in the game, Cedric ran off tackle right, scored the touchdown. That was all she wrote. It was over. We were going to the Grey Cup in Vancouver. First of all, you're looking at the Lions, the BC Lions of 1983. Roy DeWalt, the quarterback, okay? Now, I ended up getting to play with Roy, and Roy's a great quarterback. Roy's not Condridge, but Roy was an immense talent, okay? Mervin Fernandez. You go Mervin versus Terry Greer, you got a pretty good argument as to who is better, okay? And I got to play with Swerve on the same side as him, and I watched him do some amazing things. Terry's flat-out speed was unbelievable. Merv, leaping ability, catch the ball, and then make yards after the catch, unbelievable. Like it was like I had the best ticket in the house, okay? Because I was running down trying to catch up with them, which I never did. But I got to watch these guys. The Lions were so good that year that, you know, we were clearly probably the underdogs in this game. Plus, you're playing in their stadium in 60,000 people. You couldn't hear yourself think. I remember. The last practice we had at Exhibition Stadium before we went out to Vancouver, we practiced in it was a light snow falling. It was maybe an inch. And you know how that you can get in the early, in late November, you can get that little powdery snow falling in Toronto. There's no wind. It just kind of falls down, and it's very surreal. They're pumping static noise through the stadium speakers to get us used to the noise in BC Play Stadium. Okay, and they've got the volume turned up. We've got hand signals developed for audibles. We're doing all this preparation that we've never done before, getting ready to not only go out and play a very, very well-talented football team, but to get out into a hostile environment with Crazy George beating the drum, with them, you know, having microphones down on top of the stadium, down on top of the crowd, so that they reamplify the noise the crowd is making and run it through the sound system. Okay. Did you follow me on that one?
Yeah. I remember when you guys did this. It made the press.
It's craziness in that place. To top it all off, Obilovich calls. This is right after pregame. We're in the locker room. You know, the final stuff's getting done before we go out for player introductions. Obilovich calls the four captains into one of the small coaching rooms. And it's me, Franklin King, Dan Ferroni, Oh, God, I always forget the last one. And I think maybe it was Carl Brazley. And we're in there, and he says, listen, if we win the game, you guys can't get caught up in all of the celebration type stuff. You have to go to the CBC booth and accept the Grey Cup. And with that, he gets up and walks out. Leaves us sitting there. Okay. Like, huh? Me and Ferroni are Toronto kids. Okay? Me and Ferroni watched McQuay fumble in 71. And we're sitting there going, what did he, and I'm thinking, what did he just say? Really? Really? And Danny said something that kind of broke the ice, and he says, okay, I guess we got our work cut out for us. And up we got, and we went out there and stunk up the joint for the first half. Completely stunk, with the exception of the one, the touchdown and that I scored when we actually did everything we were supposed to do. And I don't even get touched before I'm actually in the back of the end zone 5 yards before Kerry Parker lights me up. But we were awful the first half. We couldn't get anything going at all. And they were, Fernandez scores, John Henry scores, they were the BC Lions. They were doing it as per the script written by the Vancouver crowd and the BC Lions fans. Later, and I really hope Don Matthews isn't going to listen to this.
Uh-oh.
But after I went to BC in 86, I found out that the Lions, under that regime, under the Matthews regime, said, this is who we are. This is what we do. We're not changing a thing. And what we did at halftime in the 83 Grey Cup was we changed a lot of things. One of the things we changed was our quarterback. Conridge had the flu and was very, very supportive in Joe taking over. At halftime. The other critical thing we changed was our defensive plan and how to shut down Merv. And that, I think, was, well, I think, geez, you know, call me Einstein. The BC Lions didn't score a single point in the second half. I think we changed some things defensively. Okay, and you know, the coaching staff did a great job of understanding what BC was trying to do, understanding what BC was having success at doing, and then coming up with a scheme to shut stuff down. Throw into the mix that Carl Brazley steals two balls out of BC Lions receivers' hands, and you know Joe Barnes comes in and throws a ball to Paul Pearson, who catches it, lands on his back and drops it, and the ball bounces right to Emmanuel Tolbert. You want to talk about the Argo bounce. You know, then Pearson again over the middle that sets up the Minter touchdown, the catch that he makes. I mean, that – I remember Carly O'Keefe had a video done after the season, and Brian Williams did the voiceover on it. And the catch that Paul makes over the middle, Brian Williams describes as the game saver. And there's no question in my mind that that's exactly what it was. That was the setup. You know, it was like BC. All of a sudden, everything that went right for them in the first half went wrong, and that everything that had went wrong for us in the second half went right. Extreme pressure on DeWalt, shutting down Merv. It was, you know, you talk about destiny. It was just meant to be. We were going to win this football game somehow, some way. And when they called the play to Cedric that where he scored the touchdown, it's called 975 wall. And what 975 wall means is you load four receivers up to the left hand side, and they build a wall, so that a human wall. Okay, it's like a pick play in basketball. It's completely illegal. But they hardly ever call it if you have really, really good actors in the four receiver positions. Okay? So it was me, Paul, I think Jeff Town, no, me, Paul, Terry Greer, and maybe Jeff was there as well. I can't remember. But we basically built a wall, and the Lions are in man coverage. so that the guy that was covering Cedric couldn't get anywhere near him. They blitz their outside linebacker. Joe's on a dead sprint to the left side, has to pull up and float one. It was like a three-pointer from well beyond the arc. Had to float one to Cedric, who's wide open because we built this wall. There's nobody getting anywhere near him. And sure enough, it floats gently, very gently, nothing but net, into his hands. And we went nuts. And the place, you could hear a pin drop. All the air, and it was at the time an air-supported dome. All the air just went out of the dome. And the only people that were cheering were the guys that, you know, the folks that had come from Toronto. Maybe, I don't know, maybe there was 1,000 of them in the stadium, if that.
A long way from Toronto.
So now what goes through your mind? You know, now we got to hang on for, I think it was 2 minutes and however many seconds it was. And, you know, you've got a quarterback in Roy DeWalt that can throw the ball 70 yards. You've got a receiver in Mervin Fernandez. Okay, yeah, he hasn't caught a pass in the second half, but you've got John Henry White that can run the football. You've got Kevan Jenkins, John Pancratz. You've got this great football team that's now got 2 minutes to get a single point to tie you. Well, the CFL, that's pretty easy.
Absolutely.
Very easy. So you're standing on the sidelines as an offense, watching now. You're not in control. Your defense is out there doing its thing. And, you know, we got them a third down. They hadn't managed to get much yardage. They tossed one up to a long ball, actually. I was surprised they went to Jacques Chapdelaine. Maybe they were trying to surprise us. You know, Canadian wide receiver, decent player, but you know, if I'm going for you know, the game winner to set Louis up to kick a single or to kick a field goal, I'm going to Murr. I don't know the play call. And they toss one up to Jacques Chapdelaine, and a lot of people blame Jacques for this, and he probably will take it to his grave because that's what we do as football players when we make a bad play. I go back to my comment on the 88 Grey Cup where the ball was coming to me for the winning touchdown against Winnipeg. You take this stuff personal. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is Darrell Wilson got his hand in between Jacques and knocked the ball away. You can see it plain as day on the replay. And that was it. Game, set, match. We win, you lose. So now you're sitting there doing all this, you're celebrating, and that thing that pops back into the back of your head going, if we win, you can't celebrate. You have to go get the truck, get the trophy at the CBC booth. Well, I'm right there. I'm immediately. I think Ferroni beat me. Okay, but I'm there second, and Carl and Franklin get over there, and now you've got Jake Goddard basically handing the cup to Danny, and he said I thought his choice of words was fantastic. Toronto, you've waited a long time. It's coming home, and you know, with that, you know, the party started. I mean, it was a great feeling, you know, to be that kid sitting on the couch watching the game in where McQuay fumbled, and to the point now where, you know, to Obilovich's credit, he let the two Canadian captains carry the cup off the field, myself and Danny, and you know, that picture, I look at that picture. The front page of the Toronto Sun, it says, at last, Argos win Barnes Burner Grey Cup back in Toronto after 31 years. I see that front page of that every day. Mm-hmm. It's in my office with, let me see, I'm counting now, 1, 2, 3 other pictures of my football life. You know, one's from Conridge, you know, a personal note from Conridge of him dropping back. Another one is a shot of me and Danny with a cup that's taken from the stands. And, you know, that's it. That's what I hang on to.
And those
there was nothing. The Blue Jays hadn't landed on the radar screen yet. The Leafs were obviously not doing much of anything. We were it. You know, we averaged 46,000 people. I think the Eastern semifinal, we might have touched 50,000 Exhibition Stadium. And, you know, depending on who you listen to, there were 100,000 people lining Bay Street for that parade. It was goofy. me and Danny were in one of the cars. I mean, these poor guys who own those cars, they would have had to have gotten new paint jobs on all of them, because there was I don't think the Metropolitan Toronto Police anticipated how many people were going to be on the parade. You know, as a comparison, I saw pieces of the parade live from the 100th Grey Cup, and everybody was very, very well behaved. They were all standing on the sidewalks. Well, this was a completely different scenario. Okay, these people were standing in front of the cars. They were standing on the side of the cars. They were standing in the back of the cars. They had decided, those who had made great big huge signs. I got a great picture of me and Danny in our car. We're signing autographs. There's an Argo. The sign's got to be 12 feet wide behind us. People are carrying it. I'm getting past wineskins. It was goofy. It was all supposed to be done in 2 hours. It took 4 hours to get from Union Station to City Hall. Joe Barnes, you know, there's some footage of him. He decides he's bringing his kids to the tournament. To the parade. His kids are like 4 and 6 years old. He's got his arms around them, fearing for their lives. Because everybody wants to high-five the kids as well. You know, it was absolutely nuts. And I'll never forget it. I'll never ever take the other picture. There was a fourth picture, and that's the poster that Carly O'Keefe, our owners at the time, did for us that showed, you know, three or four pictures. They had team pictures there. Then there's a picture of the Generals, Conridge and Joe. And there's a picture of the Eastern Final touchdown with Cedric scoring, and a picture of me and Danny carrying the Grey Cup off of the turf at BC Place. But the backdrop of that poster is Bay Street and the parade. And you can't see the cars. You can't see the players. You can't make out anything except this swarm of Argonaut fans. All of them. It was unbelievable. Completely unbelievable. And you can attest to this, that they hadn't had it up until that point, and they've never had it since. Even with the 92 Blue Jay World Series thing, that parade didn't touch up. So let's get really, you know, let's remind people, this wasn't, you know, Vancouver after a losing game seven. This was a celebration. This was it was mayhem. But it was friendly mayhem, if you can put those two words together. This was a great time. I mean, I wish all of those people, I wish that 20% of those people that were on Bay Street that day would buy Argo season tickets right now, because gee, how quickly we forget this great franchise that hasn't gone in the tank since '83, that has won I don't know how many Grey Cups since '83, quite a few, that has had, you know, one of the most exciting football players ever to play in this league in pinball, and now has the most exciting player probably ever to play in the league in the Flying Hawaiian. Folks, get your season tickets, because this is not only the oldest professional football franchise in North America, it is also the most successful. You know what they need? They need a McGill University. Somebody build a stadium at the University of Toronto, please, or York or somewhere.
Are you aware that next year they'll be playing an exhibition game at Varsity Stadium against Montreal? Yeah.
I heard that. I know what they're doing. They're trying to get people to test the product.
Absolutely.
I get that. But there's been a lot of very, very smart marketing people that have tried to figure this out. And what I mean by this is, you know, why in a catchment area of 5 million people can you not get 20,000 people to a game when you have a great product, great athletes, great entertainment? I don't know. I used to claim to know the answer, and I don't anymore. I thought when they won the 100th Grey Cup, when the CFL world unfolded as it was supposed to at the end of November last year. I really thought that that was going to be it. This is going to be glory days for the Argonauts for at least 3 or 4 years. And from what I'm hearing right now, season ticket sales are below what they were last year. And we're only 2 months away from training camp. So I don't know. You know, I build the stadium, and it worked in Montreal. You know, everybody, you know, they got out of the Big O, they went down to McGill. It became boutique football. Can that work in Toronto? God, I hope so, because I would, you know, the alternative is the Toronto Bills, and I'd really hate to see that.
Well,
thing. And when I'm saying they, I'm talking about the Argonauts organization. I've been privy I've hung out with Beth Waldman. I've hung out with Jason Solero. That, you know, these are people that don't have their names written on their backs. These are people that are in the trenches, that are doing stuff, that are working their tails off, coming up with programs like the anti-bullying campaign, coming up with other, you know, initiatives whereby, you know, high schools in Toronto that don't have football programs now have football programs. All of this stuff that they're doing is bang on, it's spot on, because it's building a fan base for the future.
Absolutely.
Okay. And that's, you know, that was the mistake they made in 83 after we won the Grey Cup, was they just sat back on their laurels and said, you know what, the Beer Boys will, and I'm talking about the CFL, not just the Argonauts.
Absolutely.
The Beer Boys will always be at war. Molson will always be fighting with Labatt's. The Bats will always be fighting with Carly O'Keefe, and that means we're going to have great, big, huge television contracts, and nothing else matters. Well, guess what? They lost a whole generation of young kids, primarily boys at that time, because they stopped marketing to them. And the Argonauts in this generation are doing that. They are so all over the kids and trying to get them to be fans. But, gosh, they got a lot of competition. Internet, the hype that is the National Football League, okay, all of the different sports leagues that are going on. There's so much competition out there right now but you would think that they should be able to carve out 25 to 30,000 people a game. You know, in a market that big. Jeez, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I really don't see the difference at all. The Sky Dome is the problem. They need a different stadium, one that is a football-friendly stadium, one that is easily accessible from major arteries or public transportation, and you know what, money talks. I mean, you know, if the Canadian Soccer Federation is upset because they got their knickers in a knot over something that happened in at York, you know what, saner minds need to prevail. You know, if you're going to do something, let's do it for the. Let's not forget here that whether you're the Blue Jays, the Leafs, the Argonauts, or whatever the soccer team is called, you are also in the business of promoting physical education for kids. Okay, let's try to make all of the teams as successful as possible. Let's create partnerships within the four or five professional teams, so they're all talking to each other about how they can, promote sport, promote physical education, promote health among youth throughout this thing. They all need to get their heads together and think about what it is that they're doing and what their strategies are. You know, going down the road 2, 5, 10 years and see where do they want to be as a sports, as a professional sports city, if you will, down the road. Don't just be concerned about yourself and, oh, he wanted to go build this over there and, oh, now I'm mad at him and he didn't tell me about the press conference he was having and now, you know, I got shuffled off to page 5. Work together, guys. Work together.
Closing this interview, and before we go, we mentioned that you played in BC. You went to a Grey Cup. That's great, but we're running out of time, and I wanted to talk for a minute or two before we leave about the Renaissance man that is Jan Kurinci. Moss does not grow under you, literally. You were born in England, moved to Toronto, went to Moncton. Now you're on the east side of Africa. You know, you're not just
slot back. You've played so many positions. You are a person of variety, not only on the football field, but also in the business community. You've done so many different things, from sportscaster to, as you said, promoting BC Place. Is Jan one of those guys that, Jan, one of those, I keep wanting to call you Jan, Jan, one of those guys that's easily bored?
Ooh, that's a dangerous question, especially depending on who's listening.
Exactly.
No, I don't think it's easily bored. I think it's, my wife, Michelle, loves to say, well, guess what? We're off on our next adventure. And I think you can include adventures. You know, going to Maryland was an adventure. You know, geez, you know, you grow up basically in Toronto. Let's back up. My mom's adventure was leaving England and coming to Toronto and coming to Canada and trying to figure out what that was all about. And then I decided to go on an adventure to Maryland and then come back to Toronto. Okay, everything's cool. Everything's, you know, everything's the way it's supposed to be. And then all of a sudden, Obilovich says, guess what? We're going to trade a Toronto kid to the BC Lions for a Vancouver kid. And I looked at him and I went, I'm not going to sell any tickets to him this, bud. And I said a few other things, but that we can't repeat on air. But, you know, that was just silly. But you know what? The adventure continues.
And one of the biggest...
And I remember leaving Toronto. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and one of the biggest thrills for you must have been being the holder for the kicker, Louis Pasaglia.
Yeah, there was a lot of good times in BC. There's no question. BC, you know, if we want to talk about what Toronto's, I hazard to say not necessarily doing for their players, and that would be wrong, because there is a core group, Laurie Bercy, if you're listening, I haven't forgotten about you, that really appreciates what it is that their players are doing. When I got traded to BC in 86, I discovered a province that was in love with the BC Lions. I mean, it was unbelievable. We had training camp in the Okanagan Valley, a little place called Kelowna. If you ever get a chance to go there, do it. Yep, warning, you might not come back.
The vineyards are beautiful there.
Oh, some of the best wine produced in the entire world. But they love this. Why? Gee, guess what? The Canucks had been done nothing and were just barely alive, and there wasn't anything else. There was your BC Lions, and that was it. We were like, it was bizarre. It really was. I mean, it was like what I would imagine the NFL would be like if you were, you know, playing for Green Bay and living in Wisconsin. But aside from all of that, you know, it's you look at life and you know, stuff happens to you. Like, I'll give you an example. We spent 11 years in Moncton, 11 great years, and got to know some great people. And when I say we, I'm talking about my wife and I and my daughter as well. And did some amazing things from a community standpoint. The Atlantic Canada, as everybody has heard, is really, really community-driven. It's all about what it is that we can do to lift ourselves up off with our bootstraps, okay, to pull ourselves up. And we had some amazing success stories. And then one day, the board of the Atlantic Lottery Corporation decided that they didn't like the color of my wife's eyes. And we were gone. We were out. You know, it's like when Obilovich said, guess what, I'm training you to BC for Nick Hebler, a BC kid who's going to come to Toronto and play for the Argonauts. And oh, by the way, just in case anyone's listening and remembers, Nick Hebler lasted 2 weeks with the Toronto Argonauts before they traded him to Regina. Nice trade. So, you know, you get dealt cards that you sometimes are in your favor and sometimes aren't. And I think anybody that's listening, I mean, everybody's been through this. You don't have to be a professional football player to be through this. You get cards dealt to you. And last, you know, in November of 2011, we got a card dealt to us that said, gee, you want to spend 2 years in Mauritius? And we looked at each other and went, well, gee, let's go first and find out what it's like. And we weren't here more than 2 or 3 years and said, yeah, why not? It's Jan and Michelle's next adventure. And now it's Jan, Michelle, and Leah's next adventure with our daughter. You know, like we started tonight, you know, my daughter was at swim lessons today, and she got back to me and said, Daddy, I'm getting real happy with my freestyle. And you know what? That's part of the next adventure. All part of it. We're helping. You know how I spent today? We had a serious flood here. We got 6 inches of rain in less than an hour. It's the rainy season here. And that happened 2 Saturdays ago. 11 people were killed. And obviously there was a lot of damage done. And we've spent the last 2 weeks, members of my daughter's school, kids, faculty, have spent the last 2 weeks cleaning up a 3-room schoolhouse that is adjacent to one of the canals that couldn't handle all the water. The water was 2 feet up on the walls. Water, mud. And you can imagine that the cleaning, fortunately, most of the buildings here are built out of concrete. So you don't have to worry about drywall and wood, and you don't have to worry about ripping all of that out. And the concrete is a little, yeah, the concrete's a lot tougher. You can clean it. You can restore it. So these kids, you know, from the ages of 12 to 16, have been getting their hands dirty, and you know, we've been down there. You know, the adults that have been able to do it, and I'm fortunate because, you know, I've got the time. You know, my wife is the star of the family now. She's the breadwinner. She's the reason we're here. So I can go down there and do that stuff. And, you know, we'll be down there tomorrow and Friday and to hopefully finish everything so that these kids are ready to go back to school on Monday. Because here it's a different system. They're at the end of their 2.5 week, what they call fall break. Okay, because we're almost into winter here. Winter, by the way, means 29. it's just not as humid, which is a real nice relief. But you know, that's the type of stuff that you know, you take pictures of, because I'm a firm believer at the end of the day, all you have left is pictures. And you need the pictures to bring back the memories, because sometimes the concussions that you got playing football don't have the memories. Oh yeah, there's the picture, I can remember now. And, you know, with Paul and his book, I've been going through pictures of you know, the Argo years, the Lion years, and more so the Argo years, obviously, because don't forget that's where I grew up. And, you know, I do bleed double blue. I do not bleed burnt orange and brown. I have an affinity for them. I had a great time at the 99th Grey Cup when they won it, but I had a better time at the 100th Grey Cup when the Argonauts won. So, hey, life's an adventure, and we don't know where the next one's going to take us. We're enjoying this one right now. You know, one of the funniest stories that there is out there is the 84 Eastern Final, which if you've got time, I'm willing to throw out there.
Throw it out there.
52,200 and I don't know how many people packed Exhibition Stadium for the Argonauts versus Hamilton for the 84 Eastern Final. Game played mostly in the rain. Dieter Brock versus Connors Holloway. And it went back and forth. There was several plays that could have gone this way or that way that didn't for whatever reason. But one of them was a punt return that I had late in the fourth quarter, and I took the ball, and again, a right return, and I could see, it was like the parting of the Red Sea, okay? This lane opened up for me, and I took off down it. And then all of a sudden, I get this flash of blue hitting a guy in white, gold, and black in the back. And the next thing I see is this flag coming right towards my head, because Sterling Hines had just clipped somebody. And the referee is now throwing, what they do is they throw the flag at the player that did the infraction. Well, Sterling was behind me. I had to basically duck to not get hit with the flag. So I know this is coming back. It doesn't matter that I've got another 20 yards of field to run in. All I'm thinking about now is, where is Bernie Ruoff? If everybody remembers, Bernie Ruoff was the punter place kicker for the Hamilton Tiger-Cats in the early 80s. Because guess what? We are now probably going into overtime. It's probably going to be one on a field goal or a single. I'm taking their kicker out. Yeah, I'm looking for him. And sure enough, I get by everybody else, and there's Bernie. And I give him everything I've got. I lower the shoulder, the helmet. This would be considered illegal in today's game. I deliver the blow. I'm trying to crush him. We both go down in a heap. He jumps up. He says, "Nice run, Jen. Too bad it's coming back." No concussion. He's not out of the game. And guess what? He kicks the field goal that beats us in overtime.
Wouldn't that be the case?
Never forget that one. Anyway, that's what CFL was all about back in that day. I don't know that it's the same game, but it's still a great game. And that's what we got to remember.
Absolutely. That was a great story. I mean, the dirty play that never happened, Jen. And it's nice of you to admit that. And obviously...
Sure. Oh, hey, wait a second. I wouldn't call it dirty. Come on, man. Part of the game.
Well, I'm referring to the fact that they burned alone.
So there was one Grey Cup victory with the Argonauts, 1983, 30th year anniversary coming up.
Well, thank you
year.
For tuning in for tonight's Candid Frank Lively
Calvary game, August the 23rd.
Have a great one, everyone.
And probably all of your old time favorites from the 83 team: Connor Holloway, Carl Frazley, Terry Greer, Dan Ferrone.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Thank you for tuning in. Jan Karinci, 1983 Toronto Argonaut, 31-year drought ended that year with the Toronto Argonauts winning the Grey Cup. My goodness. Great memories. I hope you enjoyed this time with Jan Karinci. I know I enjoyed doing the interview. We'll see you again tomorrow. We're back on the air tomorrow.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Thank you for joining us tonight.